So then it's all set. And so maybe I just pick up on that in the sense that I'm going to report about the activities of our research group. And before I start now about the Casimir, at least I want to give you a slight glimpse of the kind of activities we have. So we are dealing with the theory of inhomogeneous condensed matter, which means either you have broken translational symmetry by surfaces or interfaces, or systems are anisotropic, think in terms of liquid crystals, for example. Now, one subject deals with nanofluidics, where we address the issue what kind of new phenomena will occur if microfluidics is scaled down to the nanoscale. We are interested in the limits of miniaturizability of lab-on-a-chip devices. Wetting phenomena, there you have liquids in contact with fluid or solid substrates. And if you have solid substrates, you can endow them with either geometrical or chemical structures. And this has, if you do that on a nanoscale, this has repercussions on the performance of wetting on macroscopic scales. And we want to relate these phenomena. If you have a fluid interface, say here in a pneumatic, here's the isotropic and the pneumatic phase, you can have colloidal particles floating at this interface. And there are interesting structure formations occurring at this interface due to capillary forces. In the case of alcohols and water, for example, then charge degrees of freedom become very important to determine the structure formation there. This is a biologically inspired topic, so we are interested in the entropic force fields occurring if you have macromolecules dissolved in a solvent and you try to integrate out the degrees of freedom of the solvent, leading to effective forces. You will see now we have studied a tube model for the DNA and its folding and unfolding as function of the solvent. Down there, we are interested in soft matter and interfaces. So if matter is soft, then you can influence the structure as well as the dynamics of these soft materials by exposing them to a geometrically or chemically structured surface, and you can try to imprint the structure deeply into the bulk of soft material. And the kind of materials we are interested here in are liquid crystals, platelite particles, polymers, polyelectrolytes, ferrofluids, and things like that. And now here, this is now the subject of my talk today, critical phenomena in confinement. And this spills all over also to dynamic problems. So for example, dynamic issues of the Casimir force or other dynamic issues, for example, aging problems or self-propelled particles, catalysis, etc. And so now my contribution here will now focus here on the critical phenomenon. So then you have a slight idea of what's going on with us. Now I thought in starting this lecture, I would like to share with you how I got into it. And this started when I visited Saclay in the early 80s, and I was talking to Daniel Besance, who was carrying out experiments with colloidal suspensions. Actually, at that time, colloidal physics was regarded as a bit of an unclean system because it's badly defined, it's used by chemists, it's just not a nice physical object, which I think now has changed over the last decade. It has matured in now a really fascinating and very fruitful materials system. But at that time, Daniel Besance was carrying out the following experiment. he used a binary liquid mixture, a mixture of an oily substance, lutidine, and water. And if you have just this binary liquid mixture as the phase diagram of that as function of temperature versus concentration here of lutidine, exhibits a phase separation such that if you are at a low temperature here, the two liquids mix, and if you increase temperature, they start to demix, here into a water-rich phase and here in a lutidine-rich phase. Typically, this happens if you cool down the system, but this particular one has the, also a lower critical point. So this is just a certain choice of a binary liquid mixture. And now his idea was to now throw in silica particles. And what he observed is, by shining light on that, laser light, is that close to the two-phase coexistence curve, on the water-rich side, there was focculation going on. And the silica particles focculated before the bulk of the liquid phase separated. And you see that in particular also happening close to this lower critical point. So if you zoom in, which you do here, you see here the two-phase region, and the hatched region is the one in which you observed this kind of focculation. And the important observation was that this is not a kinetically arrested phenomena, but if he decreased the temperature again, the focculation was again dissolved. So you could do that forth and back. And what you see here is that, and maybe later on you may appreciate, that the focculation was strongest not at the critical point, but slightly off. Now, at that time, actually, they were not particularly interested here in the critical point, but they thought of that more in this region here in terms of possible wetting phenomena occurring on the surfaces of these colloidal particles. And the idea was that the wetting film forms around these spheres, and if they come close to each other, they connect and form a liquid neck, and this way they start to stick together. And so they tried to interpret these phenomena in terms of wetting. But now at that time I was also interested in the wetting phenomena, but I was intrigued about what's going on here around the critical point. Now, if you get these phenomena on in France, then it's always good to see. Yes?
This is flocculation, and what do you see?
You see just literally, as I have shown here, they fall to the bottom. Here. So they focculate and go to the bottom of your tube, and then they dissolve again. So you see it vividly by the scattering of laser light. And they underwent then some effort to interpret the scattering intensity in terms of effective sizes of these particles. So you look at small angle scattering there. Now, our chairman here might forgive, but if there are experiments on French soil, then it's really reassuring to see them also happening on US soil. And this was then some years later in Pittsburgh, where they looked at a similar binary liquid mixture, and now not silica sphere, but polystyrene spheres. And here I have put down some specifications. So the mean radii of these particles were ranging over a wide region. You have a varying surface charge density. It's pretty poorly dispersed. And the mean distance between these particles is, well, it's a rather condensed phase, so three times the mean radius. And the temperature resolution near the critical point they could achieve was about 10 to minus 4, which is, well, nicely close to TC. It means that the correlation length for the concentration fluctuations here is about less than 400 angstroms, which, however, is sufficiently large compared to the molecular diameter of the liquids such that you really can think in terms of being within the critical regime. But this is still small compared to the sizes of the particles. And what you see here is that by changing charges and surface modifications, you can move this focalization regime from even one side to the other. So there are obviously control parameters available to shift these phenomena as compared to the one I have shown before.
What's the wetting regime in these figures?
Well, this is up there.
Is it hashed mark that says wetting regime?
Yeah, well, I think I won't comment on that. So that was, so to say, something they thought that they could infer from contact angle measurements, that there is a wetting transition associated with this temperature here. But you see that this focalization is, so to say, not tied to the occurrence of a wetting here.
The Coulomb propulsion, obviously very sensitive to salt concentration.
Yeah.
Was that adjusted or carefully, salt carefully removed?
Well, this was played with. So they changed the salt concentration, and this inter alia led them to move these things around here. And you see also that here this is much deeper, here it's more shallow. So I think they just played around with the parameters without, so to say, analyzing them systematically. And here you now see in full glory this occurrence of an upper and a lower critical point now for water lutidine. And I want to show that because this will play a role later on. You see now on a different scale, here is the lower critical point, then you have the two-phase separation loop, and here is the upper critical point as you usually expect it to happen at the higher temperatures. And here the focalization regime is given by these crosses and between the crosses and the full curve. Yes. And so the idea is that you have now these colloidal particles, and they act now as attractive sinks for one of the two components of the binary liquid mixture. It's unlikely that these colloidal particles are neutral with respect to the two liquid molecules. One of them will be preferred, and this will create a halo around them. And these halos may then overlap with each other, leading to an effective attraction, or it may also overlap with an adsorption occurring at the walls. And so this is the basic setup which I was exposed to at that time, and kindled my interest into this subject. And actually, then at that time, I also had the nice opportunity to join forces also with Hans-Werner Diehl. So this was actually in a common project, trying to understand some basic features of the kind of forces which occur here. Now, here I would like to mention that I had the privilege to work together with a number of colleagues over the years. So I should say that the progress in this area is not something which you can achieve instantly. So I think we've worked on that now since the early 90s. And over the years, some knowledge has been built up. And more recently also, I had the opportunity to work together with an experimental group in Stuttgart to shed additional light onto these phenomena. Yeah, now Now forget about the spheres. Suppose spheres are big, they are close to each other, and locally you have a sort of a film. And now you want first to understand the free energy decomposition of such a film. And here you have the film, the liquid film, confined by a substrate 1, and here a substrate 2. And the free energy of this liquid, and I should emphasize that here we have to deal with liquids, because only if you have a soft material which is connected to reservoirs and which can enter and leave the system, you can expect to see effective forces. So if you would have phenomena here in solid state physics or say in magnetism, you won't see any forces. They do not materialize because the ordering degrees of freedom cannot enter or leave the system. They are tied to the lattice. Only if you are dealing with a liquid, you have a system which is responsive to these free energy changes. I think this is important to realize. Now, this free energy is now a function of temperature and film thickness. You divided that by the cross section of the film and divided by the characteristic energy scale. And then this decomposes into a bulk contribution, which scales here like the volume. L times A is the volume. Then you get a surface free contribution from this interface as if the other one would be macroscopically apart, the corresponding one from the lower one, and then a finite size contribution which is going to vanish if you increase the distance between the interfaces. Now this free energy, the total free energy, will itself decompose into a regular contribution, which will be unaffected, basically, from the critical phenomena, and a singular contribution which appears if you now drive this liquid towards its critical point. And naturally, we are now interested here in this red piece, which has the additional feature that you can expect some universal properties of this. I will specify them just in a second, which means then that if you have universal features here, you can have access to them by studying various representatives of the corresponding universality class, for example, spin systems. So that means, in theory, you have access to possible forces here by studying spin systems, but only because they are in the same universality class with the liquids which are under consideration here. Now, just to remind you about some basic notations about bulk properties near the critical point, we are interested here in the reduced temperature. We approach the critical point either from above, then here we have a plus sign, or from below, then it's a minus sign. The correlation length diverges with the power law, such as also the specific heat does. The correlation length is, there are various ways to define it, either by the exponential decay or as a second moment of the two-point correlation function, such that now you have to distinguish various universal and non-universal quantities. The exponents, mu, alpha, and also the ratios of these amplitudes of the correlation length above and below, they are universal bulk quantities. And psi naught plus, psi naught minus, and these amplitudes here, they are non-universal. And this is a very settled knowledge about bulk critical phenomena. To give you an example about a specific one, which also will play a role later on, and which is studied in much detail and with high precision, this is a transition of in helium-4 between the superfluid and the normal fluid transition. This is in the so-called XY universality class, so you have an order parameter which is, has two components. It has the property that below the critical point, the correlation length is always infinite due to Goldstone modes. Above the critical point, this amplitude is well known experimentally. And here are the values of the critical exponents. And you see here that we are dealing now with a condensed matter system where we argue about third digits. So in the condensed matter world, we are here dealing with phenomena on a high precision scale.
Sorry, question. You are dealing with a three-dimensional critical behavior.
This is now all 3D.
When psi becomes larger than L, the system is effectively two-dimensional.
Yeah.
And then things change a lot.
Absolutely. And I will, that will be a, yeah. So I only want to set the stage that we have the common notation, knowledge, and then I will try to slowly get into the subject. Now, as I said to you, you can now view these phenomena also on a lattice, because this is now conceptually somewhat easier and also for some computational purposes. So we are now considering a system where you have just d minus one dimensions being macroscopically large, and only one spatial extension is finite equals L. And take, for example, here a simple cubic lattice with spins sitting on the lattice sides, and they are now exposed to two types of fields, either a bulk field H or surface fields acting just on the spins on the top or the bottom layer. And now if you are getting close to the critical point, the correlation length becomes much larger than the lattice constant, which allows you to map the problem onto a continuum theory. And there has been a lot of effort to figure out what is the fixed point Hamiltonian in describing the, providing the continuum description of these critical phenomena. And cutting a long story short, it turns out that you end up with the standard Landau-Ginzburg Hamiltonian plus two modifications due to the confinement. First of all, you have a finite volume here, and then you pick up surface contributions from the upper surface and the lower surface, and the relevant contributions to study these phenomena are keeping track of quadratic and linear pieces here. And that's it. What turns out to be important are boundary conditions, and it turns out that there is a finite number of fixed boundary conditions. They can be classified as being of the Dirichlet type, Neumann type, extraordinary one, where you have the effects of having surface fields acting, and periodic or anti-periodic boundary conditions. One should add that this Neumann boundary condition here, this cannot be maintained beyond mean field. There are subtleties involved, but I don't want to go into that. But you should just keep in mind that now these finite size properties will be characterized by the bulk universality class and the corresponding surface universality classes, which are characterized by the various boundary conditions. So this is what you should keep in mind. Now, you already mentioned on that, that of course, if you are dealing with a finite size system, you have crossovers of critical phenomena from 3D to 2D. Now, what happens, first of all, to the phase diagram, the most important issue? So if you have now equal surface fields, and they are negative, that is opposing the bulk field, then the bulk phase diagram is just here, this black cut. Here's the critical point. And if you now make the system film-like, then what happens is that this critical point moves down, acquires then a d minus one dimensional critical character, but this also bends. So this is just what happens if you confine the system. If you have no surface fields involved, then this phase transition here is not shifted. It remains at h equals 0, but only shortens. And you get now a shift between tc of L as function as compared to tc at infinity. And for thicker films, this tc moves into the bicritical point. And it does so with the power law, like the thickness to 1 minus over L2 minus 1 over nu. And here it's written down that this is the bulk behavior, and if it's finite, then you obtain then a critical transition at Tc of L with a different bulk exponent, namely the one, the two-dimensional one. Okay, so this so much as background information.
You just have in mind helium, because if you have real fluids, then the temperature field would be a linear combination of deviations from temperature and the chemical.
This was now for a magnet. This was just for a magnet. Just to get some basic knowledge about the finite size scaling. Yeah. And now we want to focus, as I said, on this finite size contribution. Here I have put down again this decomposition of the free energy. And now you can crank the machinery of field theoretic randomization group. And it turns now out that under this analysis, this free energy can acquire the following form, such that if you divide it again by the cross-sectional area and KBTC, then you obtain here a power law, 1 over thickness to d minus 1, which is just also the naive dimension here of the area, times a dimensionless quantity, which decomposes into three contributions. The first one here stems from the bulk contribution. The second one stems from these two surface contributions, and the red one we are interested in stems from here. And this bracket here, in curly brackets, is now a universal scaling function, such that you see here now the scaling variable is the thickness of the field measured in units of the bulk correlation length, the bulk correlation length I should emphasize here. In such a combination that this gives a temperature variation like T to 2 minus alpha, such that this corresponds to as a second derivative to the bulk specific heat. And here you get the same now with alpha S being the surface critical exponent for the surface specific heat. And these amplitudes are universal numbers. These are the universal bulk amplitudes, universal surface exponents, and these are universal numbers here. So they are basically known, and we are now interested down here in this red one. Now, first of all, I mentioned to you before that at the bulk critical point, the finite size system is not critical. Maybe I should put this on again, just to alert you to this. Yeah? So you see, if you have either here or here, the finite size system is not singular, because the critical point is here or here or down here. Which means that now the whole expression of the free energy has to be analytic around the bulk critical point if your system is in a field geometry. And that means that this scaling function here must have the analytic properties that it cancels this one and this one, because these are non-analytic contributions, plus extra contributions. This is the analytic structure of this scaling function. And this is now written down here. So this scaling function reproduces these terms, but with an opposite sign, such that they cancel the other ones. And what is left must be an analytic function of temperature. That is a power series in tau. And if you express that in terms of the proper scaling variable y, it means that you get now an expansion of this sort here. And these are the expansion coefficients, and they are universal numbers. And these universal numbers, they are different above and below. Above and below, they are related by a universal ratio of bulk properties. And the leading term I equals zero, this is known as the Casimir amplitude, because this is the contribution at the critical point. This is what you get then here. The higher amplitudes are also of importance. For example, the amplitude delta 2 determines how the specific heat of the finite size system at the critical point increases if you make the system wider and wider, because then the singularity has to build up at TC bulk. That means this finite value at TC bulk for a finite L diverges, and how this happens is governed by delta 2, for example. So there are various interesting properties of that. What else do we know about this scaling function? Now, typically it has the property that it vanishes if the scaling function becomes large, that is, if the thickness of the film increases. Exceptions are allowed, like in the XY case, and I come to that later. One knows typically that this decays exponentially, possibly decorated with a power law in front of that. And now, what one also knows in advance about the analytic structure of this scaling function is that this scaling function must be able to manage the dimensional crossover such that at TC of L, the system must display a D minus one dimensional critical phase transition. And this means that this has to be singular, this function, at a certain value of the scaling variable, say y minus star. And this implies immediately that you can express it in terms of TC of L like this. And immediately you get out this way that the TC of L shifts with the shift exponent. Right. Now, one would now like to compute these scaling functions. And some time ago, this has already been accomplished together with Michael Grech within a field theoretical analysis, which at that time technically was pretty demanding. Now, techniques have now been refined. And what you see here is now how such a scaling function looks like. Positive values means you are above TC, negative values mean you are below TC. This is now shown here for Dirichlet-Dirichlet boundary conditions, or ordinary-ordinary. And you see here that the scaling function is negative, which means you have now attraction. It pays off to make the film thinner. What you also see here that you get here the decay to zero above TC, but then you get here in a painful situation below TC, because you are running out of steam with your analytic techniques to cover the dimensional crossover. And up to now, basically, this has not been able to address analytically. So there have been some efforts, but we are not in the position yet to reliably describe by analytic techniques dimensional crossovers. So we basically had to stop here at TC bulk. We extended that a little bit in terms of our knowledge about the analytic structure of this function, because it has to be analytic. You can extrapolate here a little bit, but this becomes then numerically unreliable. And then you can now check what happens if you have different boundary conditions. This is now the upper one, ordinary. What you see is now if you have mixed boundary conditions, like here, ordinary and surface bulk or Neumann, it means that there you change sign. So here it's minus, that means there the scaling function is positive, which means if you have unequal boundary conditions, it's repulsive. Here you see also theta Neumann-Neumann, which again is attractive. And there has been recent progress by Hans-Werner Diehl and co-workers who have been able to extend this analysis and take into account properly the formation of soft modes in the system, and then you find that here the formation of this minimum looks different. So there has been progress on that since then. You can also for the look at ordinary, periodic and anti-periodic boundary conditions, the same story. Periodic means it's attractive, anti-periodic it means repulsive, and also here in the case of periodic boundary conditions, this improvement by Hans-Werner Diehl has been achieved in the meantime to get a more accurate description of this behavior near the critical point. Now, you can now try to cover the whole possible accessible thermodynamic systems. Here this is classified in terms of the bulk dimension, d equals 2, d equals 3, d equals 4. And here you have then Ising, XY, Heisenberg. And you now can try to fill up the whole table as universal numbers. And the first one was actually carried out by Szymanczyk here. So there had been a connection to high energy physics at that time. And other contributed here. In d equals 2, you have exact results. D equals 4, you have exact results. And here, you have to do hard work. What you should also appreciate is, and this was a bit surprising, that the Casimir amplitude for periodic and antiperiodic boundary conditions is 10 times larger than if you have Dirichlet boundary conditions. So periodic boundary conditions have a more pronounced finite size contribution, an order of magnitude larger. Then you can try to study tricritical films, which has the benefit that the upper critical dimension is 3, and you can much more rely on mean field theory. You get then exact expressions for the exponents and different expressions for the Casimir amplitudes, and you gain basically a factor of 2 in strength. So tricritical Casimir amplitudes are just twice as large. Now let's turn to forces. Again, we have here our expression for the free energy. And now the forces are the negative derivative of the free energy with respect to the film thickness. And that has the effect that now these surface contributions here drop out because they do not depend on the film thickness. The only L dependence sits in this bulk contribution and in the finite size contribution. And these forces here decompose into a regular background one, where you have dispersion forces and charges and all the things you typically have, plus a singular contribution. The regular contribution, in the case that you do have non-retarded van der Waals interactions, the free energy scales like 1 over thickness squared, with this being the Hamacher constant. If it's retarded, it's 1 power more. And now what happens is that you have now for the regular contribution these expressions here, which are well known. And now how does this now compare with the singular one? You can now express the scaling function for the singular contribution to the force in terms of the scaling function of the free energy. So lowercase theta is the scaling function for the force, capital theta the one for the free energy, and you can express this in terms of that. And the important observation is now that at the critical point you end up with an effective Hamacher constant, which is the sum of the off-critical Hamacher constant plus this universal piece, which is multiplied by Kp Tc bulk. And that means you have now a situation in which the critical phenomena add to the van der Waals forces, with the additional thing that the Casimir forces do not exhibit retardation. So if you have retardation, the background forces ultimately will lose out against the Casimir forces at criticality. Yeah. What also shows up here very trivially but importantly is that the strength, the actual strength of the Casimir force depends on TC bulk. That means if you are dealing with helium, you are in bad shape, because then this here is 2 Kelvin, whereas if you deal with classical liquids, you have a factor of 100 gained, because there you have room temperature. So the strength, the absolute experimental strength, very much depends on the temperature.
W also scales with temperature.
Yeah, but not as strongly. Yes, sure. So helium also, W is smaller. That's clear.
But helium, what would be the ratio, say, of the two contributions?
Come to that.
This is also only for TC bulk coming, but if you go below, find a much bigger contribution.
Yeah. So this is now at the point. Well, and so these scaling functions for the force, they just look similar as we run for the free energy. Okay. Now we have already touched on the question, can one see that experimentally? And now this is, first of all, a problem. Because you want now to probe these Casimir forces in the plate geometry. And even nowadays, it's a big challenge to align parallel plates sufficiently. And therefore, one typically uses big balls, and so which mimic film geometry near contact. And therefore, my idea was that one has to resort to a different setup where you manage to get the two interfaces interacting with each other perfectly aligned. And what does the job are wetting films. They really have the properties just you need. And the idea is you have a substrate, you expose it to a vapor phase of a fluid, which forms a thin wetting layer of thickness L. And due to the surface forces, if this is perfectly flat, then also this interface here above is perfectly flat and perfectly aligned. And the idea is that if you now switch on a critical phenomenon in this film here, then this will add to the dispersion forces which regulate this distance here, such that a film thickness will mirror this onset of the Casimir forces on top of the background van der Waals forces. So that's the idea. Now the challenge is now to find a physical system which does this. And it means you need to have a system with a critical endpoint. Because if you are dealing with a normal critical point, then the liquid vapor coexistence just disappears and you lose the interface you want to interact with. Therefore, you need a system which even at its critical point maintains a sharp interface here between liquid and vapor. And this happens at the critical endpoint. Right. So what is the kind of description you have in mind? So this is now a character of the density distribution in the film. You have the wall, you have some density oscillations, then you have the thick film, and here you have the sharp interface, which has to remain sharp. Now you describe the free energy of this compound here by an effective interface potential, which is the costing free energy to maintain a wetting film of a prescribed thickness L. And this is a linear piece which means that it's regulated by undersaturation, that is, your bulk system is still in the vapor phase, and you form a liquid, which is the wrong phase, and if the wrong phase becomes thick, then you have to pay an increasing price in terms of L, linearly increasing. Then you have the surface free energies at this interface, the surface free energies at this interface, these are these two pieces, and the finite size one. And the finite size one has then the van der Waals background forces, and the singular piece is regulated here by our scaling function. And therefore we can hope that now this equilibrium thickness, which minimizes this effective interface potential, will reflect this scaling function. So far, so good. Now we need a critical endpoint. And therefore, the classical one to look at is helium-4. That's the bulk phase diagram. You have helium-4, solid, liquid, vapor. Here is the lambda line of superfluid, normal fluid transition. And what we are aiming at is this point here, the critical endpoint of this critical line. And we want now to study wetting films, that is the coexistence between helium-4 vapor with a solid substrate in the vicinity of this point where you form a wetting film. And you have good chances because helium is so weak. That means you are easily finding candidates of complete wetting where you have to form thick films. And I should emphasize that you need thick films, because all these statements about from statistical physics apply only in the scaling limit. That is, you have to have thick films compared to the size of the molecules, for example. So, and that means you have to have systems with display complete wetting, which means that by decreasing under saturation, you can increase the film thickness as much as you like. And with helium, this is an easy business. Yeah. So now let's zoom in into that. So here is the critical endpoint, and now you do a thermodynamic path of your system which runs in parallel to this sublimation curve, such that the undersaturation is constant. So if there would be no Casimir force, constant undersaturation would mean that along this path, the wetting film would maintain the same thickness. And now if you get within the realm of attraction of this critical endpoint here, you then expect the critical Casimir forces to be switched on and manifest themselves in a changed thickness of the wetting film. And then you can perform that for different under saturations, and that means you probe the phenomena for different film thicknesses. And then you can see the scaling, temperature dependence, and dependence on the film thickness. Well, so far so good, and now the only problem is you have to find a dear experimental colleague to do all that. And I tried the helium community, which is a very special scientific community interested in high precision experiments. And ultimately the one I was succeeded in talking into doing this experiment was Moses Chen. And this was a rough ride early on, because it is a very difficult experiment to do, simply because in the case of helium, as I shall show, is that these Casimir forces are extremely weak. So you are dealing with a situation that you have a huge background forces due to dispersion forces and a little piece of Casimir forces sitting on that, and you have now to find this difference. And this took him 2 postdoc generations to do. And in the meantime, he had cursed me that I started him into that. But this worked out finally, and so we are friends again. And I think Moses showed you all that already, this. But for those who haven't been here at that time, I would like to show it again. So he carried out precisely as told. So I have really to appreciate that he was susceptible to theoretical input. And here he, I don't want to go into experimental details, so he measured the effective dielectric constant of such a helium film, liquid helium film. And here you see about the precision we are talking about. And what you see here is here a little dip, which if you zoom in, you see here a clear dip in the film thickness, as predicted by theory, that near lambda transition, so it's just it's not precisely at zero, slightly below, but it is attractive. And it's attractive because helium-4 falls into the category of ordinary boundary conditions, because the superfluid order parameter does not couple to the substrate potential. Therefore, you really have the situation that the you have Dirichlet boundary conditions. Well, and then you try now whether it's a real critical phenomenon, then it has to sustain scaling. And here you see that he has now done a lot of curves with different film thicknesses and plotted them in terms of scaling variables. And you see here the data cloud forming basically one master curve. And if you now focus on just the temperature above TC, and that's where our analytic results had been available at that time, you see then here the black thick line is the theoretical prediction, which I think was pretty encouraging.
How much does the nature of the substrate matter, what substance you use?
This only matters with respect to the background forces. The quality matters a lot.
Right.
And so you see, I will show later that the scaling here in the minimum was not perfect, and he had then to improve the substrate, polishing it better, and then I will show you better results on that. Let's do that right away. Here you see, now, and you see that the time scales involved. So we are talking a couple of years later where this was then done. And you see now with an improved substrate, with not so many grooves and so on, they were able to obtain scaling here. Now you should, so to say, pay attention to various aspects of that. First of all, the field theoretical calculations and analytic ones, they are able to capture this little tail up here. The formation of this minimum is not captured yet because you are below TC. And furthermore, what you should appreciate here is that this one doesn't approach zero, but levels off at a finite value, whereas it disappears, it vanishes at high temperatures. And this is now a specific thing due to helium-4. First of all, because it belongs to the XY universality class, so you have Goldstone modes at all temperatures below TC, which contributes to this gap. But moreover, you have now also to deal with the fact that you have to do with surface excitations in helium-4, which also give rise to such a depression. And this has been looked at by Mehran Kala and co-workers, who really try to understand better how this offset here gets into existence. Okay. Now. I would like to finish, so to say, the helium,
okay.
And then we make a break, and then we turn classical. That would be a natural point to make. Now, when Moses was successful with helium-4, I immediately kept pushing him, keep going, now study helium-3, helium-4 mixtures, because there you have the possibility to get into the realm of tricritical points. And as I pointed out to you, new phenomena will appear there. This is the bulk phase diagram of helium-3, helium-4 mixtures. And what you see here is, this is the lambda transition. And this is a line of critical points. And here you enter a tricritical point, which opens up a two-phase region here. And yeah, now along this line, everything should behave like in ordinary critical phenomena. But now you are interested in the Casimir forces at this point here, at the tricritical point. But to be fair, you have to be at a tricritical endpoint again. And only to flash that on, this is the full phase diagram of pressure, temperature, and fugacity of helium-3. And the projection is the usual phase diagram you know for helium-4. But now you increase the helium-3 concentration, and then this lambda line turns here into a line of tricritical points, and they hit this surface forming the sublimation surface, and where this hits, this is the tricritical endpoint. And here you have to focus on, you have now to do wetting experiments at this tricritical endpoint. So this is certainly a challenge to resolution. Now, there has been also a French contribution to that by Sébastien Balibar, where he considered also this tricritical point, but he looked now at what happens here at this two-phase coexistence between the superfluid and the normal fluid phase, and looked at droplets forming there, and he monitored the contact angle of these droplets along the two-phase coexistence upon approaching the critical endpoint from below. And what he observed is that these contact angles do not decrease upon approaching a critical point as expected in the Kahn picture, but they increased. And he blamed the occurrence of Casimir forces of counteracting the van der Waals forces, which would make the contact angles to disappear. And well, it turned later on out that there has been a difficulty in interpreting the contact angles through the wall. There was birefringence there, and this increase of the contact angle no longer appears to be correct. But it's nonetheless a very nice experiment, which still keeps now on to be on an interesting topic, how contact angles here behave upon approaching this critical point. So this is still an interesting issue. But now Moses Chan kept going on that, and what he saw then is coming from high temperatures at a certain tricritical concentration. You see here now a scaling function which is repulsive. Now there's a qualitative change to helium-4. So helium-4 is attractive, negative, and now helium-3, helium-4 mixtures at the tricritical point is repulsive. So how comes? So first of all, you would think, well, it's superfluidity. Why should things change qualitatively so much? And I think Moses already showed this, these spaghettis he observed, and he called it a mess. So you see here now the film thicknesses as function of temperature for various concentrations above and below the tricritical concentration. And you have now an amazing amount of data available which await theoretical analysis. And you see here the formation of a hump. You see here the formation of a shoulder. And you just now want to know how this possibly maps onto universal properties. So this is a big challenge. And therefore, I was then very happy that Anja Maciarek volunteered to devote herself to this mess and clean it up. So this was done in two stages. First of all, you run a RG analysis right at the tricritical point, where you have analytic access to that. And it turns now out that the singular piece of the Casimir force is now no longer given by a pure power law, but because you are at the marginal upper dimension, you have logarithmic corrections. And the universal number is now not the number in front of a power law, but it's this red number here, n is the number of all the parameter components, 2 in our case, which multiplies the log times the power law. And what you see here is you win. So here, with increasing thickness, you get more and more. And if you compare the numerical results from Garcia and Chan, so for this one, you observe experimentally this value, and theory provides you with this one. So that is, I think, a fair agreement. Now, the question is now, how do you tackle now this tricotomy phenomena? And that means now you have to pick an appropriate representative of the corresponding universality class. And the one we picked is the vectorialized Bloom-Emery-Griffith model, which allows you to capture, first of all, the fact that there is a particle sitting, that there is two particles either occupying the lattice site, either particle A or B, or there is nothing. And if one of them is sitting there, namely the helium 4, you have then the XY model attached to it. So this is therefore the vectorialized Bloom-Emery-Griffith model. So you have then basically two objects to deal with. This is, one is the concentration of helium 4, this is this occupation number, and the orientational degree of freedom from the XY model, and this is the superfluid order parameter. So you have these two of them, and both are relevant at the tricritical point. Now, first of all, you have to find out whether, so to say, your bulk phase diagram of this model really fulfills your expectations. And for certain choices of the coupling parameters, this is indeed the case. This is now the field versus temperature. And here you see now a line of critical points, tricritical endpoint, first order. And here, down there, in this representation, temperature versus concentration, you see now by comparison with Monte Carlo simulations that the topology is just fine. So the topology of the bulk phase diagram of the vectorialized Bloom-Emery-Griffith model reflects indeed the one you expect for tricritical cavity. Well, and now these are calculations performed by Anja Maciarek, where she now, and that was a big effort now, just to follow through these thermodynamic paths as they have been taken in the experiment. So this is the two-phase region, this is the line of critical points. This line here is where you have onset of superfluidity at the surface, and you now follow the film thicknesses along these thermodynamic paths. And now first you now consider the helium-3 concentration and the superfluid order parameter, and what you see here is now an interesting phenomenon, and I think there now physics really comes into play. If you have helium-3, helium-4 mixtures, it is such that the quantum fluctuations for helium-3 are stronger than for helium-4, which means that at the solid substrate, the helium-3 is expelled and transported out to the vapor interface, which means that you get an enrichment of helium-4 close to the substrate, and this enrichment is effectively such as if you would have switched on a surface field acting on the superfluid order parameter. That means that you have now the substrate potential coupling to the concentration profile, and the concentration profile recouples to the superfluid order parameter such that you get now a situation for the superfluid order parameter, which, so to say, you get an enhancement of that at the surface, and out there it vanishes. And below the critical point, you get then the formation here of an delocalized interface between the in the middle of the film, which now means that here you have a situation as if you have a surface field on one side and Dirichlet boundary conditions on the other. And that means you have asymmetric boundary condition, and therefore you have to expect repulsive Casimir forces. So in this sense, the quantum fluctuations of helium-3 manifest themselves in the sign of the Casimir force.
Yeah. I somehow missed what is the basis of this curve. Is this RG?
This is now a lattice mean field calculation for the three-dimensional vectorialized BEG model.
The mean field calculation is supposed to capture Casimir?
Yeah, sure. Sure. So you see that the point is, I think this is something maybe I should emphasize in general. Just if we, in thoughts, compare quantum mechanical Casimir forces and the critical Casimir forces, I think there are two important differences. The first one is that in the critical Casimir force, we are dealing with a non-Gaussian theory. So this is the first one. I think you have not a free field theory, but a one with coupled one. This is a major difference and makes things much more difficult. And the second one is that for the critical one, you have realized boundary conditions you do not encounter for the quantum mechanical ones, namely the surface fields enhancement. So you have really effective fields acting on that, which is not the case for the electromagnetic field. And this means then that even in mean field theory, you get contributions. And this is different to the quantum mechanical electromagnetic case.
And this means that the major contribution is not a fluctuation induced force.
Well, that depends. That depends. So, for example, in the case I showed to you in helium-4, there you get it purely. Because there are no surface field acting, and therefore all the phenomena there are fluctuations only.
Above TC.
Above
TC,
yeah.
But below, you also have contributions which just.
Yeah, but
not from the fact that the free energy in the two above and below the under are different.
Yeah, but you don't need surface fields. Yeah, but you don't need surface fields for that. For the helium case, helium 4 case, you get everything on fluctuations. That's the only thing there. You have no surface fields.
If you ignore fluctuations, you get also a contribution below.
Yeah, I will show the picture. Yeah, but to answer his question is that you should not expect that there are no Casimir forces if you are operating in mean field.
But these results that are obtained from mean field data depend on the parameters, no? Or are they universal in some sense?
This is. See, you are dealing here with now a representative of this universality class. So you can now pose the question, if I would pick a different model, how much would I be able to reproduce that? This we haven't done yet. But the expectation is that if you operate in the right universality class, you are in good shape.
Yeah, but the thing that you're talking about is not a fluctuation phenomena, as you said. It's just because of the bay surface.
Yeah, but again, I think it would be a misconception to assume that the presence of the surface field spoils universality.
No.
Also, this is, so to say,
suppose the surface fields in the model, rather than being applied at one layer, are applied exponentially.
Yeah.
Would you get the same profile?
Asymptotically, yes, in the scaling limit. That is, of course, you will always get corrections to the leading behavior, and these corrections will depend on how you realize your model. But the leading asymptotic behavior should be the same. As long as your changes you do are, to say, irrelevant. So, if, for example, if you induce surface fields which decay too slowly, then you are kicked out of this surface universality class. Then you have to expect something else. But for example, you can pose question, how about van der Waals forces, substrate potentials? This we also looked into in detail, and also Hans-Werner Diehl. And there are some subtleties involved there, but generally speaking, you are on the safe side. And this is now the scaling function for the force. It just exhibits these features you have seen before in the experiment, the formation of this big hump, which reflects the presence of these strong fluctuations of the interface forming in the middle of the film, and this moves forth and back, and this gives rise to this big hump. And you see here then this shoulder formation and all these features we have seen before in the experimental data. And if you now want to compare phase on with them, this is done here. So the dots are the experimental data. The red one is the vectorialized Bloomer-Emery-Griffiths model. And they are forced to coincide here at this point. And you see here then that these shoulder formation and this are captured reasonably. So I think this means now I stop with the quantum helium quantum fluids, and so we can make now a break.
Yeah.
And I would resume then with classical liquids. So then, just take now a deep breath and let's continue. So there are just two slides I want still to show you about the quantum one, namely what is now the comparison between theory and experiment below TC. So that was something we touched upon. Now, first of all, you try to do your best analytically always, and below TC for the XY model, what you can do is a mean field theory. And this is now shown here in blue. This is now the theoretical curve you observe in mean field theory below TC. Above TC, in mean field, this is zero, identically zero. But if you do then the fluctuations, you pick up a little tail here. You see it here in red, experimentally. The red curve is the experiment. And if you blow this piece here up, you see it here, the red curve, this is the analytic prediction from our field theoretical calculation, and the dots are the experimental results. So here I think we are in relatively good shape. The question is, what about here this deep minimum appearing? Now, first of all, theory doesn't give you a good hold on the absolute depth here, because you don't know the strength of the coupling constant in the helium in the Landau-Ginzburg Hamiltonian, which has to enter. So you just normalize it with respect to the absolute value. So it's normalized to 1. And then you see that the overall feature here between theory and experiment is not too bad, but it is such that you get it shifted. So it's not sitting on top of each other. This one obtains by carefully following up the non-universal amplitudes coming into the theory here for the scale. And you also do not see this leveling off here. So with your analytic approach, and this has also been carried out by Mehan and co-workers, so I think you get an idea how it looks like, but it's not quantitatively reliable. And as I said, you don't get the leveling off. So, but you see, you I think from a sufficient distance.
It's a peak.
The problem is, I mean, the reason you're getting this deep minimum is that the theory predicts a sharp transition to an older phase. But in the case of helium, you just have to transition to a phase that's quasi momentary.
But I think this is out of dispute. What you get is from a distance, you see. I think an experimentalist would say theory predicts here a deep minimum.
The mapping off is connected to the GC of the bulb, also of the film.
The leveling off is associated with the appearance of the Goldstone modes. But not only, there are various contributions leading to this suppression here.
Yeah, I think we have discussed this. So on this scale, that would be the GC of the film.
This would be just at the minimum. The theory, the analytic theory, tells
the theory, but for the experiment,
it's somewhere else.
It is roughly more or less around the same number. It's around minus 10.
This is now just in the new Rathmore-Twiss article by, published, where they reviewed that. Gasparini. And what?
This is the experiment of chance. So he said that.
This has been now nicely analyzed by Gasparini in the just Rathmore-Twiss, which just appeared. And so, if you want to get into this detail, the story is as follows. It turns out that the minimum. The minimum of the experimental curve coincides with the position of the maximum of the specific heat. But the maximum of the specific heat does not coincide with the TC of L, because this is going to be a Coster-Thales transition, and this happens on the left wing of the specific heat. And therefore, it's somewhere here. You have then the onset of superfluidity. And this is, so to say, And this has to do with the fact that alpha is negative for xy, because then you get a maximum of the specific heat. You don't get a divergence of the specific heat. And the positions do not coincide.
There is no indication that the peak in the heat capacity and the dip here have anything to do with the two-dimensional Coster-Thales transition.
Now, could you rephrase?
So there is a Coster-Thales transition that Moses Chan finds through his shared experiments that's roughly around minus 10. Mm-hmm. That if one were to look at the heat capacity of the two-dimensional Coster-Thales transition, there is a peak that occurs at some temperature above the transition.
Yes. And
you're saying that peak has nothing to do with the observed heat capacity peak in this experiment. That I think has to do with the crossover from two-dimensional to two-dimensional. It's not to do with the two-dimensional Coster-Thales.
Yeah, but the peak of the heat capacity in the film seems to coincide with the position of the minimum. And what I'm saying, and the TC of L occurs at a lower temperature. Yeah. This is what I'm saying. So I thought to have said that,
but maybe I misunderstood. I thought you made an association with that peak and the fact that if we do a two-dimensional XY model, there is a peak that occurs in the
past. That was not my intention.
I was wondering, obviously, so the theory curve you draw there, it does not show this kind of strong kink or leveling off towards the low temperature.
No, so the theory says it goes to zero.
Yeah, but it doesn't have this particular feature.
Yeah,
this seems to be connected to the crossover to 2D behavior. I mean, at least in the experiments you see, but he says that around minus 10 you have the TC of the filament. So I think he's somehow referred to this point of strongest curvature as the point which indicates the TC of the filament.
But this so I cannot.
That's not public. Is the theory describing the dimensional crossover correct?
No, here, this one not. Okay. No, here, this, there you have no dimensional crossover. You have, so to say.
Okay, that may be the reason.
Yeah.
If there's no temperature, they can't get corrected because you would have to put in the spin width, you would have to improve the mean field.
That's probably the reason you don't see this feature.
The transition that you want in the theory curve is right at the bottom.
Yeah. This is this here. Yes.
Right.
So I think there is now agreement that we should improve on that. And for that purpose, we made an effort to now run Monte Carlo simulations to just achieve that. And what you see here is now the symbols are the Monte Carlo results, and the black curve are the experimental results. And this has been, so to say, carried out. There have been two analyses of that, one by Hucht in Essen, and in parallel by our group. And the agreement is basically the same. So there are different type of Monte Carlo simulations.
So I guess my question is, we know that to understand the low temperature side, the Goldstone modes are not sufficient.
Yes, that's what I emphasized.
The surface So why is the surface fluctuation ignorable at the bottom of the peak?
No, it's not ignorable. You see, here you have a difference.
No, I was asking the minimum.
The minimum, yeah. There is this contribution from the ripples at the surface. They seem to be important here, but not here. And we have now improved on this on the color simulations with higher accuracy and so on, and the picture is further sharpened. And so this is I think now. Mm-hmm. And I regard this as really, pretty assuring. I think that this agreement is substantial.
Now, in this case also, there is presumably a Costa-Lizotte transition in the simulations.
Yeah, sure. But this is very hard to detect.
You don't.
Well, you see, Hasepusch has done some analysis, so there are ways. If you really push hard, you get some evidences. So for the real Monte Carlo aficionados, they work on that.
Derivatives of the curve.
Yeah. But it's an essential singularity, so it's nothing which jumps in your face.
The location of that, would you expect to be at a universal position in X, or do you think it could be system?
Well, if there would be no ripples there, yes.
Hasselbusch has an expression, and we determine the shift of the. I mean, how the Costa-Lizotte temperature scales with L. So there's something like 7.5 times TCL minus TC over TC to the minus mu. For the Costa-Lizotte. So I mean, one could.
So what actually surprised me even more so was this agreement here. And this is, so to say, there is no fitting done. I should emphasize that. There is here now the absolute depth as well as the position, everything is fixed. There is no fudge factor around. It's head on, and I think this is remarkable. And it's the more so remarkable since seemingly the van der Waals forces as corrections do not seem to be of great importance. So if you really now compare head on the numbers, you would also like to see effects of corrections due to van der Waals, and they do not appear. Yeah, but the corrections are of more subtle form. It's not just additive.
Okay. Oh, okay. That was always the assumption. Yeah. The experiment with the
additive. Yeah, yeah. But this is only the primitive first step.
Okay.
But there is
so
it's more involved.
Non-additivity contributions are not important. They don't. Yeah.
They obviously seem not to take place.
Okay.
Yeah. And so in that respect, I think now understanding the phenomena is now basically achieved. Still, of course, everybody is highly welcome also to do now additional analytic work here to explain the Monte Carlo data. This is certainly.
This involves also correction to scaling, and you have to adjust the amplitudes and so on, like a 1/hour correction and stuff like that. So,
yeah.
I mean, that's in that sense, the one still has some fiddling around.
Well, this.
We found that taking into account corrections to scaling shift the curve in a vertical direction, but the position at x is fixed, is the same. But that's true that these are quite small systems, and one has to, just to obtain the data collapse, one has to take into account corrections. And we did it kind of phenomenologically for different kinds of corrections, and for which we have obtained data collapse. And now the lesson is that, yes, the curve is changing, but only vertically, so the position is kind of independent.
Mm.
And we've been correcting for this aspect ratio, and
well,
of course finite size.
I don't understand. I mean, if you choose a different parameter for the corrections, then probably then you don't find such a good data collapse, right?
Or no, we tested even the form of corrections, the functional form of corrections were different.
So maybe to keep the audience on board on that. So the issue is now, if you do Monte Carlo simulations, you do it certainly on a finite size system. And the issue is, how do you properly extrapolate to the thermodynamic limit on the basis of your available data? And this is, in general, a tricky story. And this is also, I think, something you would have to discuss at length, how one does it, because there are various parameters you have to extrapolate. And now this appeared as a EPL letter, and we have now worked out a longer manuscript where we have detailed this analysis thoroughly. Assuming various kinds of finite size, the form of finite size corrections, and those who are interested in that are called and invited to read that manuscript. It's certainly an important issue, but I think it doesn't spoil in any way this nice agreement. But there is certainly the message is not it's done. I think both the simulations and analytic work can continue here. So this is not yet a complete end to the story. Well, now if you look at it, it looks like as if starting out this comparison between theory and experiment with helium was actually to say starting on the wrong side, because it was so painful to get these experimental results because the Casimir force is relatively speaking so weak. So if you would now switch to classical liquids, you are scheduled to gain a factor of 1,000. Namely, you have get a factor of 100 by being at room temperatures, so that scales between 2 Kelvin and 300 Kelvin, But moreover, for classical liquids, in distinction to the quantum ones, you always have fixed boundary conditions, surface fields acting. So you don't get rid of them. And the Casimir amplitudes for these boundary conditions are 10 times larger. So you gain altogether a factor of 1,000, and that means that when these Casimir forces are supposed to jump in your face, they are not, so to say, a needle in the haystack to be found, but they should jump in your face. And so actually, I was happy that Moses Chan was the one who started out with the helium-4, because if it would have been done first with the classical ones, I doubt whether the helium community would have jumped on it to do, so to say, the second experiment. So fortunately, the more difficult one was done really first, so that then the other one could follow, so to say, as the easier ones. And there the idea is just the same. You are looking again for a critical endpoint. And in a binary liquid mixture of A and B, in the thermodynamic space of temperature difference and sum of chemical potentials, you typically have these sheets of first order transitions between vapor phase and a fluid phase. And if you cool down the fluid phase here, phase separates into a B-rich liquid and an A-rich liquid. And the red lines are lines of critical points. These are lines of liquid vapor coexistence, and these are lines of segregation, critical lines of segregation. And if this hits the first order phase transition boundary here, this is the critical endpoint. And therefore, we are now studying wetting phenomena around here. And so for these boundary conditions, it turns now out that as a function of these scaling variables, you expect now that the forces are no longer maximal at the critical point, but above the critical point. So here you have comparison between T equals 4, T equals 3, and T equals 2. So you have this phenomenon that the Casimir forces in these systems are strongest not at, but above the critical point. And now remember slightly what I told you early on from Besson's experiment. There the Foucaultian set on was strongest off the critical point. So there's a sort of resemblance, at least, of that. Well, and now question is who would do these experiments? And there I tried to Peter Pechen at Harvard, whom I knew for a while in doing wetting experiments. And therefore, I talked him into doing these experiments, and they did it with synchrotron sources. So that's his specialty, and with the synchrotron sources and evanescent wave scattering, you are able to measure with high precision thicknesses of wetting films, but not only thicknesses of wetting films, but also composition profiles throughout the wetting films. So you get also a spatially resolved information about this. And he did so, and here are the data. Let me explain. So these are the scaling functions for the forces. As function here of temperature for various concentrations and various film thicknesses. And what you see here is that the upper cloud of curves are those which appear for the limit of thick films. So this is what he observed at the critical point. If you focus now on the maximum at the critical point, you compare this as function of undersaturation. In a certain way, he arranged that. I don't want to, with a temperature gradient, this is a too difficult story to tell. But what you should measure here is the amplitude, the critical Casimir amplitude for thicker films. So less and less under saturation. So these are the thicker films. And these two dashed lines are the predictions of this value from RG, and this is a prediction from this Fischer-Deschenes functional with which you can compute this critical adsorption and Casimir forces also. I should say that this is a third method which has been now developed to capture the Casimir forces in the presence of ordering fields. This Fischer-Deschenes functional does not work in the case of in the absence of surface fields, because that's only fluctuation supported, and then they get out zero. But if you have then with the surface field, this is also turns out to be also now numerically a highly accurate approach. And there have been recent successes with that. Yeah, and down there you see now, to say, the curves. So this is the prediction, the mean field prediction up here. D equals 2 is this prediction, and these are the measurements. So they somewhat nicely lie in between. And now you want also to compare that with the Monte Carlo simulations. Here you see that these bluish ones, these are the Monte Carlo simulations. The red ones are the experiments. And this is mean field and D equals 2. So it's not as spectacularly the same as for the helium. And I suppose here the error bar, experimental error bars are also larger. Whether they are, so to say, capturing that completely, the errors, I don't know. But it looks encouraging, at least. And down there, this is now, they had the boundary conditions plus minus. So you had the situation, a liquid-like wetting film. On one side, the substrate has a preference for the A particle, and the liquid-vapor interface a preference for the B particle. And this amounts to opposing surface fields. And this means repulsion, as you can see. In the case that you have parallel surface fields, you expect attraction. There are no experiments for that situation so far. So in this case, these are the only available data from Monte Carlo. This is T equals 2 and mean field. And lastly, here is now easing and periodic boundary conditions. And this is now something we can tie in with the analysis by Hans-Werner Diehl. You see that these are the analytic curves and these are the simulation data. So also here the minimum seems to appear slightly below TC, even for the periodic ones. Yeah. So I'm now 5 minutes left. So my talk was formulated then about background theory and applications for Casimir. And now I'm on the verge of getting to the applications. And I just show you how far we can get during the talk, and we see how we can continue. And now we want to play with that. And that means I'm now coming back to this colloidal world. So it's now getting full circle. Now after we did a lot with the films, now let's get serious about the colloids. And that means now that we play now the critical Casimir forces against geometry. And so now we consider colloidal particle. You have now three length scales which you play off against each other. And the length scales are the distance between either two colloidal particles or a colloidal particle and a wall. its size and the correlation length. And now, what kind of phenomena will you then get as function of these scaling variables? This is now the issue. Now, first of all, let's get straight about description in terms of scaling functions. This is again the fixed point Hamiltonian, and the free energy decomposes now again in a bulk piece, a piece proportional to the surface area, a piece proportional to the surface area of the particle, and the finite size contribution. And this adopts then a scaling form. Maybe I should push it up. And that you should keep in mind now, because these variables will now appear again and again. Theta measures basically the temperature dependence. Delta measures basically the distance between the particles. This is the crucial variables which now enter into the description. And what I'm now reporting here is on the mean field level. This is mean field analysis with this geometry. And here you see now the Casimir forces relative to its strength at TC as function of temperature. And you see here the characteristic peak above TC. This is what you observe. You can then look at the dependence of this maximum as function of the distance between the particles. So delta equals zero is the Deryaguin limit, where they are big particles being close to each other, whereas the other, the green limit, is the small radius expansion. That is, you have a small particle far away from the other one. And in d equals 4, you can see these limiting values, and you see that the position of the maximum shifts as function of this distance between the particles. And this shifting of the position of the maximum interpolates between the Deryaguin limit and the small particle expansion, and it has a maximum appearing in between. And this can be also been investigated beyond mean field theory, because in the Deryaguin limit you can reduce that to the parallel blade geometry knowledge, and the small radius expansion is then an expansion in appropriate operators, and this has been worked out together with Erich Eisenregler. And here you see then the effect of dimensionality. The upper curves are those ones which you get for d equals 3, and the lower ones for d equals 4.
So this is.
In principle, yes, but this is a bit daring. It's a bit daring.
Is dependence proportional to radius is just because of Dirichlet?
No, you have don't Dirichlet. This is now always with surface fields. And this is now a situation in which both particles have the same affinity, parallel ones. And this only should tell you that also beyond mean field theory, this maximum position can be followed in great detail. So we have a very good account of these structures of this scaling function. This was so far between sphere and wall. If you now have two spheres, interestingly, what happens is that as function of the distance, you can have either the maximum or none of them. That is, the red one means at small distances, you get the maximum, and if you separate the particles, you lose the maximum, and the maximum is then at TC. Yeah, and this is now also mapping out this position of the maximum rather precisely. What one should now also study is the dependence of this critical Casimir force on the deviation from the critical concentration. So far we have considered, so to say, the temperature variable, but now you basically map out the dependence on the bulk field, so to say. And this also is such that as function of the bulk field, if you go off criticality, the maximum is less pronounced and shifted further away. This is what happens. Yeah. And lastly is now the comparison between the Casimir forces and the dispersion forces. And in the case that we have at criticality and at the critical concentration in D equals 3, and you see here in green the interaction between a sphere and a wall, and in red you see the interaction between two spheres, and as function of the distance between the objects. And what you should see is that Casimir wins hands down in both cases.
How do you compute the dispersion?
This is now just a choice of the Hamming constant. Say a typical choice of it.
But then it's supposed to break down in some radius as function of distance.
Yeah, yeah. So this is then one where you have retardation taken into account.
Particularly if the radius is small. So if you go to the line where your dispersion forces go down, they're supposed to be much bigger than this predicted.
Yeah. Well, this is... Well, we took just, so to say, a typical Lifshitz expression for it. And
that's for two spheres. This is two half spaces?
No. The red one is two spheres, and the green one is a sphere and a wall.
So, in principle, you can't use Lifshitz.
Yeah.
Okay.
But, you see, this is a huge difference here. And rather,
the Casimir curves up there, they are also based on the same approximation. The Hamming approach is assuming kind of additivity.
No, the Casimir. And this is, so to say, just, and actually at far distances, this is really exact because here we have this small particle expansion.
Yes, operator.
Yeah. Yeah, and so this is, what to say, really D equals 3.
So in principle, that should do the same thing for this.
But so to say, the message here is that you are having good chances that the Casimir forces overwhelm the dispersion forces. And this is now good news, because now this is the case where you have now parallel surface fields, and that means these are attractive forces. Now, if you have then anti-parallel fields, then they are going to be repulsive. But if they are then of the same, of the comparable magnitude as here, it means then that with the repulsive Casimir forces, critical repulsive Casimir forces, we are able to beat the background dispersion forces and get overall repulsion. And how this is revealed experimentally, we would have to discuss in a different session.
Okay.
This would now be a rush. So I think I...
I'm not very sure I'm understanding what's the power. This minus, for example, the minus 2.04,
yep,
which you say is going for interaction between two spheres with a limit of long separation.
Yeah.
The force, not the energy, force.
The force.
Going off as the inverse square.
Yeah.
With the assumption of just having metallic surfaces or something.
No, this is the critical one.
But just only the critical.
This is only the critical contribution.
Okay.
And there you have, so to say, these non-integer powers.
Right.
Here you would not expect any non-integers powers, so they have to be different.
Okay, so should
so
we...
Typically when you're doing the full Van der Waals-Lipschitz thing, so when you go to these long distances, you have individual terms, right, coming even from the zero frequency. And you're saying that this, and then that goes back to giving you an inverse 7-4, so long distance, even with complete vibration. You're saying that this is giving you an inverse square at this very long distance, and the source is...
For the Casimir.
Just for that.
No, so for example here, this is simply say you have two small spheres very far apart from each other and retardation, and then this is the kind of power you would expect here.
Hang on, I'm trying to get all this temperature stuff sorted out here. So
no, this is there is no temperature. This is now at TC.
Right.
There's no temperature dependence.
Well, at any temperature at long enough distance, you see the so-called zero frequency terms.
Oh yeah, you mean in this piece?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
This piece, yeah.
So is that big or small compared to the Casimir when you have these two small particles? You're saying it's tiny compared to that. I'm trying to get an intuition why that should be.
So maybe we need to continue at the discussion since people will be comfortable strong in about 5 minutes.
Oh, yeah.
Okay,